Hello, this is Bob and Cameron McEwen, and we're recording the 74th episode of our ongoing explanation, exegesis of my book on Trump and the tech body. And we're at page 158, in the middle of the page, and we're looking at a fantastic quote that McLuhan and Barry Nevin end their book, Take Today, The Executive Dropout, 1972. They end the book with this quote. Page 297, we mentioned it last episode that we'd be doing it. But in talking to Cameron before the recording here, he found a quote in McLuhan's op-ed in 1974, I think it's September 21st or something, 1974, where he talks about stuff that nobody has acknowledged yet. And to me, well, I had been explaining some of the stuff about Coldplay. An exciting thing has happened. Our Coldplay is now, our technology for endless electricity, generating endless electricity, is now public. And so I was talking to Cameron about it and reminding him of this quote. So when he said it, I remembered it. I remember that sentence. But he applies it to what we're doing with ION, whatever ION is. So I said, let's start with that quote. So Cameron's going to read from 1974, McLuhan op-ed.
The September 21st, in fact. And in the preceding sentence, he talks about what he calls the perpetual interface of flux.
Mm.
Right? So he goes on from that and he says, however, in the pulsating world of the intervals, which I guess is another way of saying perpetual interface of flux, in the pulsating world of the intervals in electronic information, there are innumerable opportunities to seize and abstract the interval itself as a new kind of object to be exploited.
Yeah, now that article is titled A Media Approach to Inflation. The economy is starting to go crazy after the oil crisis of 73, and then Nixon gets Watergated, and then nobody knows. New York City goes bankrupt in 75, and it just gets strange, the economy. So that's the beginning of the futurist part, and he talks about the futurist role in the economy, and that's exploiting the interval, exploiting the interval for economic reasons. So this point that where tactility was the ground in the 20th century via the extended electricity, or the extension of our central nervous system, it now becomes a figure and exploited.
Correct.
Now, you have the merger on page 11 of Take Today of man is both figure and ground, and content is ground. The form and content have merged. So I don't know if you could say the tactile interval is is just a figure. It's still the ground, but something has shifted. We moved somewhere else, and probably I would say with my tiny note chart, which was not done for another 20 years after that article, we are shifting into something anthropomorphic in the Dobbs quadrant of the chart, anthropomorphic. The projection of raw human, what humans might think they are as opposed to everything else, they think they're different. It's a new kind of anthropomorphism, and that would mean that would be the ground for this tactility or the interval becoming figure. That's the best I can say about it. The rest is all interactive dialogue.
In the same paragraph, he says, inflation makes everything a figure against the ground of public interest.
Yeah.
So public interest there can be taken as what you were just calling anthropomorphism.
Yeah. The human people thinking that humans need to know something, you know, public interest. And of course, it could be, there's many publics under electric conditions, so the word public is more 19th century. And he also says that human interest comes in journalism with the telegraph. Human interest. Journalism before that was, politics and ideas, not the crazy stories that we have nothing of on, say, an organ like the Daily Mail. You go on there and there's millions of ridiculous stories about crazy things that people are doing that are maybe of human interest. So I always remember that word in relation to the word public interest. Now, that might have been picked by Barry, so it might not have McLuhan resonances in it. But anyways, you're right. Public interest. Look, what a strange way to say what is left after the erosion of all media. You know what I mean? What is left is public interest. And I guess the admin have been trying to figure out, anticipate where the public interest would go. And usually they don't figure it out. They get in there real fast because there's less cultural snobbery about getting involved with pop culture, you know, over the last 50 years. So the marketers, they just look for where the kids are. What are they? What ridiculous thing are they into now? Oh, there it is. Doesn't matter whether it's culture or not. Just fucking sell it. So that's the teenagers are the antenna of public interest. I just made that up.
So public interest is ambiguous, right?
Yeah.
So when he later says opportunities to seize and abstract the interval itself. What an opportunity does on one side is turn into interest in the financial sense of exploiting a new kind of object.
Yeah, that's fitting right? the new into the old tools.
Yeah. So when he says everything a figure against the ground of public interest, that has many, many meanings.
Yeah.
But one of the meanings is financial, just like one of the meanings of inflation is financial. But in neither case is that the only interest. It has to be seen in the spectrum of the senses.
Right. And I would say, you know, the public, McLuhan said, was a 19th century extension of the printing press in that era, and it was a homogeneous, solid thing. Then the electric world smashed it and decentralized it, and many different publics happened. But as the world imploded under holopathic global theater conditions, you could come back to what McLuhan called a collective consciousness. That could, we now have a public, which is every 8 billion people engaged in that public. You know, it's reamalgamated, and I could see using the term public in that new way.
Yeah.
It's like the, what do we call it? It's the Android meme or the resonant node. That stuff, that imploded node that people, the whole world lives in. And whatever they're looking at, that's public interest. There's one public again, so to speak.
Yeah.
And if you're trying to translate it into finance, you're going to put it into 19th century terms. So that's another aspect of public financial interest or how it can be exploited. Because everybody's engaged in a collective espionage, looking how to jump off the industrial establishment, the pay rent, mortgage, all this stuff, into some kind of glorious, endless income. You know what I mean? That's what everybody is waiting for, that opportunity.
That's right. And McLuhan talked about that from very early on. It's the privatization of public asset.
Asset? A-S-S-E-T?
Yes, sir.
I was going to say that it's the what was the word? Extrapolate. What did you say?
I said it's the for McLuhan. What the economy is basically the privatization of a public asset, and the public asset in the widest sense is the public itself.
Yeah, and the public interest, the resident node. So the privatization of public asset, I had an idea about that. And it's an odd kind of privatization, not a 19th century privatization. Actually, it probably goes back to what we're talking about. The pre-tribal autonomy is that's what people want. They want autonomy from the global marsh pit. You know, and that's what billionaires, their charisma is, they've got autonomy, supposedly. And that would be the privatization of public access and asset. And the public asset is the collective Android meme phenomenon we're talking about, which now has become the tech body, that everybody is like a page of Finnegan's Wake, multiply connected, interfacing, interpenetrating, interpellating, POMO word, all this ridiculous, incredible interaction that's going on by our five bodies and more. And its goal is the privatization of the public asset. And the public asset is that collective consciousness of all kinds of things happening and new phenomena popping up that if you get in there early, you might get some autonomy or cash.
Yeah. So it's autonomy in an old sense.
Right.
What's wanted is something that is yet to be defined. So in that situation of yet to be defined, we go back to some sort of aristocracy or something in the past.
Yeah. And the, again, another thought, the privatization of public asset, the, see, we're all looking at everything. You're looking at the news or whatever part you pick up. Trump is a major figure in that. He's the asshole, the public asshole as asset, right? And, everybody's looking at how to privatization is like going back and getting any kind of analog media that's now privatized. And you're constantly involved with this digital chaos slash fascism, totalitarianism, that everybody's a victim of and can exploit. So it's the most democratic reality that ever could be in terms of opportunity. Now, the disservices are nobody can take responsibility for the effects of their actual privatization.
Sure. But plus, the big disservice is that the whole environment is has its own acceleration now.
Yeah.
That is completely out of individual or even collective control.
It's even hard to get what to be what you could claim is the public interest.
Correct.
It doesn't stop enough to find out what it is today.
Sure. So you have the exploitation of public interest at the very moment that public interest has disappeared.
Yeah. And part of the exploitation is that you're part of the elite that can dictate the big patterns we talked about last week. So you're in the White House. You can name. Biden can name what everybody has to do, and he rules what is forced on people to claim is the obsolete public interest.
Yep.
And then what's interesting is that it looks like he's involved in everything. And McLuhan used to talk about this, the super connectedness of the electric situation, which creates paranoia, but it makes everybody involved with everybody. So everybody looks like they're part of some conspiracy if you actually hook them up over something, right?
Yep.
The connections of them become, they go all over the place. Now, there's probably a fact in the Biden's connections, China, Ukraine, and all that stuff, but what is the legal context if they can keep hijacking the public interest? And we don't know, you know, Trump is all happy that he's getting indicted for the fourth time. The donations come in, he's going to sell T-shirts of a picture of himself in jail. His moves are we don't know the success of what he's doing to bounce off his absurdity with Biden's absurdity. You know, two
right.
absurdities happening here.
Yeah, well, it's like your phrase, the civil war of the media.
Yeah.
Because what's going on is far bigger than individuals fighting with each other or trying to get elected or something like that.
That's where you get into the tech body. It's the machinic fighting among itself right in front of you and pretending, making you think you're part of it.
Yeah. But we should note that when you talk about the legal situation is a piece in a chessboard, right? So that it's not as if the legal situation is one thing.
Yeah.
The legal situation is a whole bunch of things that can be assembled in different ways and used in different ways. And we're seeing this use of the legal situation right in front of us.
Right, and so that's where it's another way of everything being interconnected. anything, a legal situation become a sport thing or an entertainment or
correct.
A war. All the categories overlap like a page of Finnegan's Wake. And that is what you got to learn how to be detached from. You got to see why,
that's right.
how that's happening and how it's going to suck you in at some point. It's always going to pop up something that you didn't think you'd be interested in, and all of a sudden you're interested in it, and you're dragged in to
right.
an aspect.
Well, you always have been dragged in. It's already
yeah.
happened in the
yeah.
past.
Yeah.
Right? And yeah. I just noticed that for everybody that you used the word reamalgamate a while back.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's from Joyce. And now you're bringing the conversation back to Joyce again.
Yeah. Well, nothing beats the Finnegan's Wake for what it shows. It's a painting of our situation, or it's a movie of our situation, or it's a TV broadcast, or it's some maniac talking the whole. It's like Ion talking 33,000 hours, you know. But it's quite remarkable. It is, when you get to this level we're talking about, it's an aesthetic appreciation of what's going on. It's aesthetics. It doesn't stay as aesthetics. Then all of a sudden it becomes responsibility or terror or something else. But there's an aspect of getting this that's enjoyable. The mind likes an aesthetic pattern. And what we're describing
definitely.
Is an aesthetic
situation. It's another way of exploiting the situation.
Yeah. Yeah. So the I have to see if it comes up again. So I had another aspect there. You got public asset, public interest. So the public interest is the interplay of all these things that we're saying are mixing in with each other, and that's the tactile interval. The interplay of all these things. So interpolating, mutual merging, reamalgamation, and then crack up, that is what tactility is, because tactility is not a sense. So we've actually hoiked up nothing as a exploitable object. And so much of
correct.
Wealth today is made from nothing, from stupid gossip or just nothing.
Sure. And can be said to be the death of God.
Yeah.
Right? When tactility is taken to be an exploitable asset, then God has died.
Yeah, and so that's the beast. The mark of the beast or the Antichrist, those archetypal themes. God's got a tough time. I remember Norman Mailer. What'd you say?
That's, again, the Civil War of media.
Yes. And Norm Mailer said in an interview in 73 that technology had gotten, and, you know, he was well-versed up to a point on McLuhan, so he probably had McLuhan in mind. He said technology got to the point that both God and Satan were nervous. they were being threatened.
What? Nervous?
Yeah, nervous, apprehensive. Technology was going to wipe them out. And so you're saying, yeah, God got killed. So there it leaves it up in the air about how to bring back God or whatever that is that people anthropomorphically think they need. That's the crisis. And I guess you would call it, that's the identity. How do you bring back the God identity?
Yeah.
How do you bring back something special?
Correct. And what McLuhan's formula is that people want to bring back something special, that is to say something particular, but you can only do that by becoming hyper-general. So to put it into media terms, if you want to preserve the values of the literate civilization, the only way you can do that is by talking about media plural.
Yes.
So if you understand media plural, then you can go back to the literary environment, and you can live in it in a new way.
Yeah, and so the content of the literary is speech, so our dialogue is a way of doing what you just said the task is.
Correct.
Right. We're doing that. We're talking.
We're trying, anyway.
What? Yeah, we're trying.
We're trying.
and we're doing pretty good, and we know how futile it is, but you still have glimpses of temporary success or aesthetics, interesting patterns.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that relates directly to this great quotation at the end of Take Today.
Right. Let's go to that.
With programming the unconscious.
Right. So the making the news in the first line, that's making the public interest of the moment. Making the public interest.
Yeah, that's, 1800 to 1950 or something like that.
Right. So it says, last page of the book, page 297, the familiar idea of making the news, and this is on page 158, the familiar idea of making the news now yields to making the world itself. Now, there, that's amazing, right? Making the world. Now, we were trying to say that, to make. And to realize you're in the middle of the making process. You're helping to make
Correct.
The world.
But it's very important to realize that the word make in McLuhan is a technical word.
Yeah.
It does not only mean fabricating something. Making is what is different from merging. Or matching.
That could be the anthropomorphic.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That names the task and virtue of the anthropomorphic at the same time that it names its finitude and limitation.
Yeah.
Right? So making is, in regard to truth, for example, is a formulation of truth that is admittedly and avowedly limited.
That's right.
And so matching is the attempt to take over truth, but that for human beings, that's not possible. That's the impossible desire that motivates human beings, but is the great evil.
Right, and the POMO, postmodern, the postmodern trend that you heard in the 80s and 90s, or till recently, was that there was no more truth. The problem with that, they did not talk about the process that made that a percept that you just did. They don't, Baudrillard and them don't go that far. They just say there's no
Correct.
Truth. You know, and it's immature. It's very limited. You've got to build on McLuhan's words to say it accurately. About,
I believe that that's correct, yeah.
Yeah, about the death of truth or why people can't find truth. So then it says, for the best part of a century, so that's 1870s, that is after Baudelaire, you get into Mallarmé and the symbolists, and what else is happening in the world? The Paris Commune.
Well, anthropology is getting born.
Right.
So that's anthropology starts up, and people start doing research into primitive cultures, like Tyler, for example,
yeah.
and Frazier. So they're doing that. And then that's also the time when depth psychology is getting started. So people are beginning to do research on schizophrenia and paranoia, and these are all retrievals and replays of tribal unconscious that are getting a megaphone in the daily press.
Yeah, and that's the beginning of the tribal unconscious or the anthropomorphic.
Yep.
They're looking for
a new sense of the anthropomorphic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Going back and looking at the primitive forms of human social organization and trying to see what is the essence or the human in there, and that's an anthropomorphic effort. So the other thing was the Paris Commune, the Franco-Prussian War. Just say it, that's enough. So anyways, that's 100 years before this paragraph. For the best part of a century, we have been programming human consciousness with retrievals and replays of the tribal unconscious. And McLuhan is not saying that's good or bad. These are technical statements. You know, he's saying exactly what's being retrieved. And in a way, it's beginning of public interest, but not as we've been saying public interest. So you go into the tribal unconscious first on the way to understanding what the word public interest, the phrase, meant today or when it was written. Mm-hmm. So
you could even say that definition of public interest is the tribe.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what a tribe is.
So it's the public interest is becoming the locus of the Android meme unconsciously.
Yeah, I think that you could say that, absolutely.
Yeah. So then, now McLuhan says something astounding, or Nebit does, to make you realize that there's more involved than the Madison Avenue version of McLuhan as a lover of the tribal or a retrieval of the tribal. You know, there has to be some more. It's more complex, and this next sentence does it. The complementary of this, there's another aspect to this thing, you know. The complementary of this process would seem to be the natural program for the period ahead. Natural in quotes, that has to be talked about. Why is that in quotes? For the period ahead. And what is that? Yeah. And it's italicized. Programming the unconscious with the recently achieved forms of consciousness. What? What is, are you seeing any form of consciousness out there? I don't think so. I don't see anybody being conscious. Whatever attempts they say they're being conscious are exploitable and leads to cults and stuff. So what the heck is
McLuhan saying? Sorry to interrupt, but we need to note that complementary is another technical word. This is what McLuhan is recording here is synchronistic with the development of quantum mechanics.
Yes.
And the great guru of quantum mechanics from the 1920s until around 1960 is Niels Bohr. And one of Niels Bohr's central ideas is complementarity.
Right. And would you say that what are the great rulers? Maybe you said rulers?
No, gurus.
Oh, guru,
I think
right.
I would have said. Yeah.
Right. So look at this. The beginning of the tactile interval as an artifact or something to be exploited, and where this is going, as you get in about the 1890s, they discover the electron. The electron is an early image of the tactile interval.
Yeah, so the electron was discovered at just at the beginning of the 20th century, right?
Yeah, I'm saying 1897. Let me just look that up.
Oh, okay, yeah. So, yeah, we're agreeing on that.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to see what
that
it
was
says.
Thompson, wasn't it, or one of those guys?
Who'd you say?
Thompson.
Yeah, it's probably Thompson. Let me see. Wikipedia. J.J. Thompson discovered in 1897.
Yep.
And then we could... How is it defined? An electron is a negatively charged subatomic particle that can be either bound to an atom or free. So it can be both.
Yeah, but this is before, at this point in time, people don't yet understand the structure of the atom.
Right.
That will come soon after.
The structure of the electron.
Pardon me?
The structure of the electron.
No, I'm saying the electron, the discovery of the electron will contribute to an understanding of the structure of the atom, which is going to come 10 years later.
Okay. An electron that is bound to an atom is one of the three primary types of particles within the atom. The other two are protons and neutrons. Together, protons and electrons form an atom's nucleus. Now, what happens 10 years later that you're saying something about the atom?
Well, yeah, that's when people learn the structure of the atom in the first decade of the 20th century, I believe. I'm just speaking off the top of my head here, but I think that that's when the structure of the atom was understood, partially on the basis of the discovery of the electron.
Right. Now, who gets credit for what you're saying?
I should know the answer to that. Who was it that It's another English physicist at Cambridge.
Okay, here's something. What is an atom? Definition and structure. Let's see if they give some anthropomorphic source of this. No, so I'm going to go to the Wikipedia, see what they say about the atom. Well, you got a problem here. It says it's a superhero. So it's some cartoon character. So how do I get the atom? The atom is a Wikipedia thing. So I'll put in atom and wiki. Okay, atom Wikipedia.
The problem is the entry is going to be huge. It's going to be difficult to get the information.
Right, so they talk about the ancient Greek thing. Then they get to the English chemist John Dalton in the early 1800s did something. And then isomerism, Friedrich Wöhler, 1874, Jacobus Hoff proposed that the carbon atom bonds to other atoms in a tetrahedral arrangement. Then Brownian motion, the British botanist Robert Brown observed that the dust particles... observe that the dust particles inside pollen grains floating in water constantly jiggle about for no apparent reason. In 1905, Albert Einstein theorized that this Brownian motion was caused by the water molecules continuously knocking the grains about and developed a mathematical model to describe it. This model was validated experimentally in 1908 by French physicist Jean Perrin, P-E-R-R-I-N, who used Einstein's equation to calculate the number of atoms in a mole and the size of atoms. Then they go into Thomson, discovered that cathode rays are not electromagnetic waves, but made of particles. Then you have Thomson seems to, it comes under scrutiny by Rutherford and Geiger.
Oh, I think Rutherford is who I was trying to think of.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he doubts the Thomson model, and they get into the alpha particles, and then... Thomson had encountered a similar problem in his work on cathode rays, which he solved by creating a near-perfect vacuum in his instruments. Rutherford did not think he'd run into the same problem because alpha particles are much heavier than electrons. According to Thomson's model of the atom, the positive charge in the atom is not concentrated enough to produce an electric field strong enough to deflect an alpha particle. And electrons are so lightweight they should be pushed aside effortlessly by the much heavier alpha particles. Yet there was scattering. So what Rutherford and his colleagues decided to investigate this scattering carefully. So between 1908 and 1913, they performed a series of experiments in which they bombarded thin foils of metal with alpha particles. They spotted alpha particles being deflected by angles greater than 90 degrees. To explain this, Rutherford proposed that the positive charge of the atom is not distributed throughout the atom's volume, as Thomson believed, but is concentrated in a tiny nucleus at the center. Only such an intense concentration of charge could produce an electric field strong enough to deflect the alpha particles as observed. Then, while experimenting with radioactive decay, Frederick Soddy, a radiochemist, discovered there appeared to be more than one type of atom at each position on the periodic table. These atoms had the same properties but different atomic weights. The term isotope was coined by Margaret Todd as a suitable name for atoms of differing weights that belong to the same element. J.J. Thomson created a technique for isotope separation through his work on ionized gases, which subsequently led to the discovery of stable isotopes. Then in Niels Bohr, 1913, proposed a model in which electrons of an atom were assumed to orbit the nucleus, but could only do so in a finite set of orbits, or could jump between these orbits only in discrete changes of energy corresponding to absorption or radiation of a photon. Then he says a bunch of stuff, and then later in the same year, Henry Moseley provided additional experimental evidence in favor of Niels Bohr's theory. These results refined Rutherford's and Antonius van den Broek's model, which proposed that the atom contains in its nucleus a number of positive nuclear charges that is equal to its atomic number in the periodic table. Under these experiments, the atomic number was not known to be a physical and experimental quantity. that it is equal to the atomic nuclear charge remains the accepted atomic model today. Chemical bonds between atoms were explained by Gilbert Newton Lewis in 1916 as the interactions between their constituent electrons. As the chemical properties of the elements, so all these guys are exploring tactility. As the chemical properties of the elements were known to largely repeat themselves according to the periodic law, in 1919, the American chemist Irving Langmuir suggested that this could be explained if the electrons in an atom were connected or clustered in some manner. Groups of electrons were thought to occupy a set of electron shells above the nucleus. So then they say the Bohr model of the atom was the first complete physical model of the atom. It described the overall structure of the atom, how atoms bond each other, and predicted the spectral lines of hydrogen. Bohr's model was not perfect and was soon superseded by the more accurate Schrödinger model, but it was sufficient to evaporate any remaining doubts that matter is composed of atoms. For chemists, the idea of the atom had been a useful heuristic tool, but physicists had doubts as to whether matter really is made up of atoms, as nobody had yet developed a complete physical model of the atom. So you have all these guys. Now, Bohr gets the credit, but there's all these guys. This is a tactile teamwork exploration of the tactile object.
Yeah.
And that's why they never complete it. They don't
public interest. It's public interest investigating public interest.
Yeah, it's the first manifestation of public interest. And the global node is happening. The resonant node. People are starting to get really imploded in the telegraph and telephone environment. So
Well, the telephone isn't there yet, is it?
The telephone's in the 1880s. I'll just check that.
But it's just a local thing. It hasn't become the network yet, I don't
That's
think.
Right.
But it's around the same time that it gets built out into a network.
Right. So in 76, Bell gets the patent. Early history. Timeline of early development. So it goes from 1844, so you get up to 1877, Thomas Edison files a patent application. In January 30th, 1877, Bell is given a patent, but then Edison gets something on April 27th, a few months later. Early commercial instruments, when do they start doing that? They're just saying the beginning of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
There's different kinds of early telephones.
Yep. So that's, notice, the electrons, 1897. The form of the atom is 1908 to 1911.
1913.
So, well, that was Bohr, I think, 1913.
Yeah.
So, but Rutherford is 08 to 11.
Okay.
So, a lot is happening at this time in science, and what will happen in the mid-1920s is that Bohr and Heisenberg and people like this will formulate quantum mechanics, and they
are going
to
That's at the Copenhagen conference in 27.
Yeah, that's right. And so the uncertainty principle will be announced, which is that with subatomic particles, which have been investigated since the electron was isolated in 97, with subatomic particles, you can't simultaneously both measure their place and their momentum.
Right.
And so that's the uncertainty principle. And so Bohr says, these things are complementary, right? That brings us back to the quotation in Take Today, where the complementary of this process, this is complementarity can be taken to be something out of the I Ching in China, or it can be taken to be the way up and the way down of Heraclitus, or it can be taken to be the most up-to-date science in the 20th century, quantum mechanics. But McLuhan is constantly talking about the flip, and what he means by the flip is the constant inversion of figure and ground. And so when he talks about complementary here, all of those senses from thousands of years of history and from technological developments like telephone networking, or from scientific investigation like we've been talking about into the atom and the measurement of particles, all of these things are built into how this works and why this works.
And it's an increasingly corporate teamwork.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so these
science is teamwork. The telephone network is teamwork. All of this is the what could be called the revelation of ground. So all of this teamwork was always going on, but it couldn't be seen. And suddenly, if you start looking at primitive tribes, or if you start looking at the unconscious that is not an individual unconscious, it's a collective unconscious, to use Jung's term, all of these things are suddenly showing the human interest that's always been in the background but couldn't be seen.
Yeah, and because it's a shrinking global village and everybody is in touch with each other, bouncing off each other, publishing and talking on phones and telegraphing each other, the team has come together. And I would say it's the last emphasis of individuals. And then you get World War II, and then it's corporate after that. And you don't have famous people. You don't have figures like Einstein and Bohr, cultural figures. What is the scientist of the 50s and 60s? What's an image? Who was the guy? Who was the woman?
It's hard to find.
McLuhan
talks about that in one of his lectures.
McLuhan was the image. McLuhan was the new scientist. Nobody recognized. In terms of the individual consciousness still being a contender, McLuhan was that.
Yeah.
That's why everybody got involved with him and got influenced by him, because he was covering on the whole thing. So he was actually coming up with the unified field theory.
Yeah.
Now,
I think that's true. Absolutely.
Right.
It's a unified field theory of the humanization of the planet.
Really
called the harmonization of the planet.
Groping towards privatization in the autonomy sense, as we were talking about. So, you know, the Copenhagen Conference, it's an argument between Einstein and Bohr and a bunch of people, and they are the figures. This is a famous picture of all those guys that are in that conference. They all become individually famous, right? Gödel and everybody's in that picture. There's about 30 of them. But see, there you're trying to say there's a literate individual that's causing this, that's making this new world. But it's really a team, and they're exploring the tactile interval or the public interest, and then that is not articulated consciously until McLuhan, and he's building on the other scientists, in quotes, Pound, Elliott, Joyce, and Lewis, right? They're exploring this thing, a new kind of science.
Yeah. So that's what I'm doing on in my Substack newsletter. I'm trying to show that it might be that quantum mechanics can't be put properly aside from something like what McLuhan was doing.
You can't separate it from McLuhan. Is that what you're saying? What do you mean you can't put aside? It can't be put aside.
I don't think I said that. You must have misunderstood.
Yeah.
I was saying that it can't be put properly, or it can't be put without contradiction, unless you go to something like what McLuhan was doing.
Via the men in 1914, via their issues.
Sure.
See, there's the. Remember, he says that Joyce takes on Einstein. That's Joy. That's McLuhan announcing, "I'm a scientist. I'm from a tradition, and we're not lab guys. We're looking at language and media, or cultural artifacts, and that's forming. That's as much as the process of forming the world as electrons."
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So the sentence that you wrote, that you read from the last page of Take Today, says what you just said.
Yeah.
But what you just said amounts to an enlargement and a clarification of it.
Right.
Right. So,
well, McLuhan clarified Joyce, and then Dobbs and Cameron clarified fucking McLuhan.
But just so I'll read that sentence again because it's so important. The complementary of this process would seem to be the natural program for the period ahead, programming the unconscious with the recently achieved forms of consciousness.
Tremendous.
Yeah, that's a very heavy sentence.
Yeah, and natural. I now see why that's called natural. It's actually absurd, chaotic, multi-level, invisible. It's not natural the way people think visually we're natural. Somebody does something. If it's natural, you can see it. It's natural. It's a cliche. And what he's looking at is something that's not natural, but it means it's the obvious way to go. Nothing to do with appearance. It's the obvious
program. It's the new natural.
Yeah.
It's what he, in laws of media, it's what he calls second nature.
Yes.
So first nature is what has been left behind, especially after the satellite. But now there is a new nature, a second nature, and that has to do with it's complementary to the old nature, to first nature, and it's going to have to do with, instead of the unconscious programming the conscious, it's going to be the conscious programming the unconscious.
Right. So the physicists are the last guys trying to figure out first nature. Then McLuhan comes in, says no, second nature, media, the virtual is more important than first nature. So then I was going to say another part. So it's not.
I wouldn't say it's more important. I think you just said that too quickly.
Yeah,
I mean,
complementary.
It's complementary. It's implicated in.
It's the newer new. Okay, so this is what they say, that physics lost its charisma in the second half of the 20th century and biology took over. But biology is the Earth as art form, right? That's what you said, the effect of the satellite. And again, McLuhan goes deeper by showing why these things become figures. Physicist falls off, biology becomes a figure. William Aaron Thompson wrote about that, how biology took over as the organizer of public interest. And it's just a figure for McLuhan's talk. McLuhan's talk is better. If you have a truth, you come up with something, you're explaining something to people, and it should be half understandable, but there's no explainer, like Thompson are explaining matter and the electron, and then Bohr is explaining the atom, but there's a new level that needs to be explained, and that's the complementary second nature, and McLuhan is the explainer of that, so he's the scientist of it. He's the one who says it and tells you what it does, and it has a huge impact. Everybody knows there's something to what he's doing, and they all jump in and try to exploit it in some way.
Right. So the term complementary, which was complementarity for Bohr, We should say Bohr, B-O-H-R, for people who don't recognize the word, Niels Bohr. Complementarity has a gap to it, and that gap introduces uncertainty. So the when McLuhan comes along and suggests a new language, a kind of new paradigm for understanding this stuff, the great problem he has is that in order to speak that language, you have to cross this gap. And there's a huge reluctance to do that. People want to use the rearview mirror instead of going across the gap.
Yeah, but they think it's a death of the anthropomorphic if they do that.
Correct. Correct.
So yeah, he's the new science. He's making a new science, and it's a qualified term, you know. Many volumes have to be written to say that it doesn't mean what you think science means, you know.
Correct.
And the achieved form of consciousness. McLuhan, so I asked Barry Nevitt, what does that refer to? And he says Finnegan's Wake. And McLuhan's the expert on Finnegan's Wake, or at least a practical use of Finnegan's Wake. And so McLuhan arrived at the new recently achieved form of consciousness.
Correct. But we didn't read the last sentence, so which is also very, very important.
Yeah.
So we need to read that.
And, okay, so I just wanted to say that, quote, arrogantly, McLuhan is declaring himself quite conscious, and other people are going to have to go through him to get that consciousness, go through his method to get a similar autonomy from the tribal unconscious. That's so silly about McLuhan, is that he's attached to all this tribal unconscious replays. That is the main means of making conventional analog media wealth, right? From music to conventions. All this tribal, trying to find what the public interest is. And you just have to stay home if you understand McLuhan, and you got a better view than whatever convention Noam Chomsky is at, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. This procedure.
So, let's just notice though that for McLuhan, the tetrad is always at work. So when he's proposing something that's radically new, it's also radically old.
Yeah.
Right?
And radically retrieved.
It's always a retrieval. So
and it's always flipping in the middle.
Correct. It's always there's just like the model of the atom.
Yeah.
And just like quantum mechanics attempt to understand that model of the atom. There is nothing that is stable. You cannot, the very attempt at stability falsifies what you're doing because of the uncertainty principle.
Yeah, and the gyroscope is an interesting image.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So it achieves orientation through movement.
Yeah. So now all this is a procedure, a formula, a method, you know, like an update of Francis Bacon's method. This procedure, now you're reading this and making the news, human consciousness, unconscious, forms of this is a procedure, sir? You know, what's the procedure here? But it is. Gyroscopic procedure tetradically. And you got that famous quote paragraph on page 614, the bottom, the Finnegan's Wake, and it goes into 615, and it begins with tetradomational. The tetrad is in there. Our whole mole, mill wheel, something tetradomational. Those words are so perfect about the procedure. Of what Joyce is trying to communicate. He's trying to communicate the procedure of how he makes the wake. And then McLuhan comes along and applies it sociologically, well, on a bigger scale. It moves it out of the verbal module.
Yeah, that word domational is a great one.
Yeah.
Right? It says that in order to understand a domain, you have to understand domains.
Right.
That's what the domational would be.
And I'm also thinking he talks in the essay on Joyce in Interior Landscape, one of the essays, he says, it is Domitian, the Roman Empire about 200 after Jesus was born. It's Domitian, this crazy guy, he's overseeing the dismantling of the Roman Empire. It's really falling apart. So it's interesting how McLuhan takes a historical figure and says that is a description of the process it's undergoing sociologically. So I'm thinking of Domitian as part of Domation.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, if you remember, look it up, you'll see he just says it is Domitian. He names the guy. I mean, let's just see, am I accurate about, is it 200 A.D. he is, or B.C., what is it, A.C.E., after the Common Era or something? The new term, Domitian. A nice it says Domitian, Roman Emperor and Tyrant of Rome.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm off 100. He is from... he's emperor from 81 to 96, so it's actually right after, quote, Jesus. So if there was a Jesus, and it's 100
just after, years. It's after Nero, and there was a whole series of tyrants there.
Yes.
And then 100 years later was when they got the good emperors for a while.
Yeah, it says, as a consequence, Domitian was popular with the people and the army, but considered a tyrant by members of the Roman Senate. Domitian's reign came to an end in 96, which is McLuhan's number, 69 and 96, when he was assassinated by court officials. He was succeeded the same day by his advisor, Nerva. After his death, Domitian's memory was condemned to oblivion by the Senate, while senatorial and equestrian authors such as Tacitus, Pliny the Younger and Suetonius propagated the view of Domitian as a cruel and paranoid tyrant. Modern revisionists instead have characterized Domitian as a ruthless but efficient autocrat whose cultural, economic, and political programs provided the foundation of the peaceful second century. That's what you're calling the nice dictators. Right?
Yeah. I think it started towards the end of the second century. Like Marcus Aurelius, for example, and the empire lucked out by having like four or five relatively good emperors in a row.
Right. Let me just see if this comes up. Roman emperors, if there's a list. Give me Roman emperors in order. Chronological list. You've got Domitian, second century. I have to get rid of these. Things are in the way. So you have Nerva. Then you have Trajan. Hadrian.
Yeah, Trajan, those are very good. Yeah, Trajan, Hadrian.
Antoninus, Pius, Marcus Aurelius, Lucius Verus, Commodus, Publius Helvius, Pertinax, Marcus Didius Severus, Julianus, I don't know these guys, Septimius Severus. Then the third century is Caracalla, Publius Geta, Macrinus. So, yeah, basically you're thinking of Trajan, Hadrian, Antoninus, Marcus Aurelius, I guess, right?
Yeah,
that gets you up to 180 at the end of Marcus Aurelius. So so Domitian is a transition there. He's a peak. He's an autocrat, extreme tyrant, but he also had some other thing going for him. Maybe he created a public order of the media of the day, and that was necessary. And too much chaos in that transition caused by Jesus. Jesus upset everything. Okay? So, this procedure would evoke a new form of consciousness radically different from former consciousness. Whoa, what a sentence that is. Anybody experiencing this new consciousness? This procedure. So the perceived, now that's making a world. He's making a new world, a new form of consciousness, consciously. And it's radically different from any kind of normal consciousness, maybe even anthropomorphic consciousness up to that point. So what a
sure.
statement, eh?
Yeah, so it's to understand that, you have there's no way to understand that as something unique, because in order to understand it as something unique, you would have to look into the future and see how that future will evolve.
Yeah.
So science fiction and things like that make that attempt. But the better way to do it, in my view, is to look back at, let's say, 1780. Look at the century between 1780 and 1880. And what happens during that time is that chemistry is born.
Yeah.
And when chemistry is born, then literally everything changes. How people work, how people go from here to there, what the environment is, how to make things, on and on and on and on. And what McLuhan predicts is that exactly that same thing is going to happen to us. It is already happening to us, but it's going to happen through a new kind of science. And that new kind of science has not yet been defined, but when it is defined, it's going to be the programming of the unconscious, but with the recently achieved forms of consciousness.
Right, and that could be indicated in his 1955 title, you know, The Alchemy of Media. That could be
yep.
the phrase you're looking for. Because
absolutely.
You have matter, which is contained in the Gutenberg framework, and, you know, they've aced matter through chemistry. Now you move out of matter, which is a product of the Gutenberg effect, into something that's living, organic, and ongoing, the electric now, which is hard to pin down what time it is. And that is the new, well, tribal unconscious at first. But McLuhan says we must become conscious of it like the chemist
right.
did.
And yes.
That becomes a radically different. You're in the second nature. You're in the interval between first and second nature, or in the third nature, or something. It's a new thing, which
correct.
The modern words virtual and cyborg are attempting to describe.
Yes,
inadequately.
That's when we met in New York in 1998, I was trying to describe. How that transition would occur. And it was my view then, and it remains my view now, that it can only occur through recognition of the forms of consciousness, which is media.
Right.
So the only when the elementary structure of media becomes generally recognized can we advance into this new sort of human world where we will know the effects of what we're doing and thinking before we do them and know them. And that
right.
will change
you,
everything.
Yeah, and you said the word elementary. That's the elements, like in chemistry. Now you
yes.
have the elements of media. Now,
correct.
That's why the linear chronological laying out of the stages of actual environments, like in understanding media, you have to bring, you know, that's where you say, well, Bob, you're being too linear. Well, you do the linear for the first part, then you get into simultaneous, and that's when you learn how to maneuver Finnegan's Wake, which is a simultaneous presentation of what was looked like linear phases or stages that you have to become aware of. That's media, because now there's no media. We don't know what it is. But the term media doesn't do it properly. So you have the history of media as establishing different phases of consciousness. So you become aware of that, and you see the process of unconscious becoming conscious in each medium era. But you now have to confront the present, which we're describing, which is not a present. We're not sure what it is. It might even have nothing to do with the anthropomorphic, which we call the tech body. And becoming conscious of that outcome is the task before people. And then how to communicate to someone else, or even if
Correct.
You need to.
And that, if we go back to the inflation article in the New York Times, the huge problem to this is that the work of trying to achieve this new consciousness, at every stage of that, it can be exploited.
Yeah.
And the exploitation is a tremendous danger that's part of the saving process.
Yeah, and it's part of the saving process. It saves
yes.
us? You're saying it saves us?
No, saving. It's not a past. It's not saved. It's the attempt at saving.
Oh,
right.
Okay.
When the world goes nuts, the McLuhan program is to attempt to salvage a new kind of consciousness, a new kind of sanity. But the problem is every step along the way can be exploited as a product, like Facebook, let's say, and that creates
an
all kinds of the danger.
Yeah.
So an unconscious that is sort of looming over us, like Goya's colossal forms.
Right. So what were we just saying? That what was the word I threw in before Goya? Forget the word I just said. Try to say what you said a little bit.
I was saying that the procedure of trying to evoke a new form of consciousness, to read what McLuhan has here, that procedure is what might be called a saving process.
Oh, yeah.
It attempts to establish a new form of sanity for a world that has gone insane. But the problem is that at every step of that saving process, there can be an exploitation, an attempt to privatize this public process, and that attempt to privatize presents tremendous danger to the world.
Yeah, the White House is the function of the president of the White House is that exploiter.
Correct. Correct. And it's the public face or the private voice of the collective exploiter, which is NATO or which is Western civilization or it's got a bunch of names.
So I think there might be one more paragraph. Remember McLuhan says, some would think it's supernatural. Is that the
yes.
paragraph before? Have you got your take today there?
No, I think there is either one more sentence or one more paragraph after this. Let me see if I have that.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Here.
After the procedure sentence, I think the word supernatural comes up.
I have take today here, so
good.
I'll just flip to that last page and a new form of consciousness, radically different from former consciousness. And then there is two sentences.
matter, are actually three if we include Finnegan Array Surrection, which is the last line of Take Today. But he says, everybody becomes a voluntary participant in creating diversity without loss of identity. Man is the content of the environment he creates, whether of hardware or software, whether of consciousness or unconsciousness. There is, therefore, no technical alternative to humanism, even though for many this would include the divine grace of the superhuman. Yeah. Innovation is obsolete. So is obsolescence. As information speed up transforms man and his world into art form.
Right.
Then again, a resurrection.
So, yeah, that was a superhuman. And that's a big part of the argument over where we're going, whether it's superhuman or not. You know, some say we're getting dumber and dumber. Others say, no, we're going to a new transcendence. See, that's the content argument. That's the rearview mirror argument.
Well, but McLuhan is saying both of those, right?
Yeah.
For McLuhan, much of his late work has to do with a critique of the superhuman.
Yeah.
Right? So this idea that we can be everywhere at once and that we can have control over who gets born and who doesn't get born or who dies naturally or who dies unnaturally. All of these kind of superhuman things McLuhan thought was terrible. But here he's evoking the superhuman in its most positive sense. So this this constant ambiguity is something that can never be got rid of, but there can be a science of it. And that science of it is the conscious programming of the unconscious.
Yeah, and of the world as art form. Media as art form.
Yeah,
that was a good little explanation there of the lines I left out. What is it, the words before, he says, but some would call the superhuman. What is the sentence, the part before that? What does it say? In that sentence.
Yeah, I'm just looking for it. So that particular sentence is, there is therefore no technical alternative to humanism, even though for many this would include the divine grace of the superhuman.
Leave that there. The humanism is generally a literate thing, a Gutenberg thing. So
that's right. But he's also alluding to what he calls homonization.
Yeah. And then you get the last page of War and Peace of Gold Village is really important. The last couple of paragraphs there, you would overlay those, you bring those ideas or words into this, what we're analyzing here. But it's really important. It could be humanism, and then it goes to the other extreme, supernatural. There's your spectrum of forms, maybe. You want to go into that, your idea of the spectrum of forms? Or what is the next part here? Let's just see what comes after this. So I point out the secret. Somebody finally asked Barry, what the hell is the recently achieved forms of consciousness? It's important to have one of them give an answer. And it's a surprising answer at the time, Finnegan's Wake. And then you have television hasn't been in the civil war between media since the 60s. What the hell am I mean by that? Hasn't been in the civil war. The global theater was the antagonistic actor, in the 60s, superseded by the instant replay in the early 70s. So I'm trying to say something new there. You know, it's not TV. That's the 50s. The global theater was the antagonistic actor. Now, the antagonistic actor is the beginning of the psychopathology of the tech body. It's going to go through the Android meme phase after global theater, but then it's going to get into tech body antagonism. And then the instant replay, that's being experienced all the time, the replay. That's your retrieval. Extending and retrieving.
Yeah.
So this sort of raises the question that we always get into between the linear and the simultaneous. When you talk about television hasn't been in the Civil War since the 60s, and then you get into the global theater and then the instant replay, what are you trying to point out through this linear progression?
That people's idea of McLuhan, and he's an expert on television, and that's as far as they go. There was so much that came after television, which was his main work in the 60s and 70s. Television is the 50s. So I'm trying to say there's a whole bunch of stuff nobody dealt with. The global theater as an antagonistic actor, and then the instant replay, and then that becomes the android meme, and then the tech body. That is important, that the layered developments of your imagery of what media are.
Gotcha. So what you're saying is the
I'm including part of the simultaneity, that categories that nobody includes.
Yeah, no, I get that, and I endorse that as well.
Good.
So it's not you're not talking at a sort of an ontological level here.
No.
You're talking history a little bit like we were doing with the atom earlier.
Yes.
You're talking about how a certain kind of consciousness was developed and how it was enlarged and enriched.
By subsequent developments. And
the
ongoing, never-ending, McLuhan says in the end of Culture is Our Business, there's no finish line. Look at the next sentence. Down on 159, the beginning of the digital, the android meme, would be the cable TV scenario in the late 70s, early 80s. Now, these are sequential processes that, for the average human, happens in sequence. There was television, then there was the global theater, then there was the replay, and then there's the digital. That's how they see it. But that's the natural, erroneous natural, right? It's natural to think of that sequence, but it's erroneous. So we're trying to get them out of the sequential, but to stick with television and just talk about what TV as media does is nowhere near explaining how we got to here. You've got
Correct.
To add these other processes that are included in the dot of the simultaneity.
Right. And when you've come up to the digital, let's say, then that gives new insight into what TV always was.
Yeah.
But the message of television still hasn't been received, let alone back in the 1950s.
What was that? By no one, did you say?
Sorry?
By no one in the 1950s, what was the word?
Oh, I might have said by no means or something.
Yeah, by no means. Okay. You got kids today, they don't know what television is, never experienced it. Now, what they do experience is the screenal. I like the way Croker subsumes these stages, television, instant replay, the digital, the android meme, what's the other one, and the global theater, as the screenal. It's all the screen. That's a good comp, and cable TV. So the screenal is the passive massager compared to the tech body. Tech body is the screenal becoming some kind of psychopath or sociopath, right?
Is it, when you say becoming, is that a linear process or is that the revelation of what the screenal always was? But wasn't understood as psychopathic.
Right. It's easy to say yes, both. But you got to know how to do both. You got to know how to do the sequence, and you got to know how to do the simultaneous.
Correct. Correct. Yeah.
So
yeah.
And the simultaneous
and the constant
would
flip
be
between them.
Beg your pardon?
And to live the constant flip between them.
Yeah. So the simultaneous is Joyce and Finnegan's Wake, and the sequential is the science part of McLuhan. right hemisphere, or even left hemisphere, as mm-hmm. artifact.
Sure.
And then they become environments. See, the left hemisphere is an environment, the Gutenberg, and then the right hemisphere is the digital or the electronic. And then maybe the digital is the corpus callosum. And that's the interval.
Yeah. Right. So, the digital and the corpus callosum is, these are figures for the underlying ground, which is tactility or the interval or the electric. I mean, the language here is very ambivalent, but it's a language that can be learned, and when it is learned, then it gives the kind of human environment that McLuhan wants to evoke at the end of Take Today.
Right, so that's the unsaid.
Yes.
And the unsaid means, if I'm doing it consciously, that leaves you room to say something, add to what I say, and how what you add determines whether you understood me or not on the larger point of the simultaneous. So all that, as you were talking, I was thinking you're groping for the word unsaid, what is unsaid. See, I can say a nice, wonderful paragraph, but it's not the whole story. And the better you're at understanding me, which means understanding the collective consciousness, the collective language, not our personal stuff, and your response when I stop and let the gap create room for you to speak, the quality of your response indicates what you understand of what I said, and assuming
close. The issue is, are we using a common language?
Yeah.
Are we communicating with each other in the attempt to introduce a new type of communication generally?
Yeah, so we're using McLuhan archival expertise to complete each other. That's our language, is our knowledge of McLuhan statements and the whole range of them. And we've done that this whole series. You'll say something, then I'll compliment it and complete it. And you'll say, exactly. So you know I understand what you're saying. I know the right words to say in response. While it has a synergistic effect where you're moving towards an interesting insight pattern that will shine at some point from this accurate interplay of us.
Correct. Correct. So we're trying to get to some place that we're also exemplifying.
We're also exemplified?
Exemplifying.
Yes, yes.
So that's the way things always work. For example, if a child is being taught language, they cannot understand the teaching without understanding language. Right, so there's a flip in time that goes on, and that flip in time defines what human beings are. Human beings live a very peculiar time that where they can work towards where they already were, right?
Where they already were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what McLuhan says in talking about Finnegan's Wake, someplace that doesn't he say? I have to repeat what I was about to say.
He says that in Something Else Press.
Explorations 8, I think.
Yes, number 8.
Or 7 or 8. Yeah.
8. Yeah. Let me repeat what I was about to say.
Correct. Correct. And that sums up what we're doing and what human beings are always doing.
Right.
But the big question is whether they can become conscious of that. This peculiar notion of time.
Yeah, McLuhan said once that his work is for those who have a superiority complex. So having the recently achieved form of consciousness, we're moving towards a, quote, superiority complex, seeing what everybody was saying, but we're adding a level of consciousness because we're including all the different categories that Gutenberg created of knowledge, of brilliance, of expertise, and we're able to subsume them into present awareness, present extension, and that's a talent to be able to do that, to take all that's happened and not be impressed. That we're at a newer place than that, than what we master in all the different disciplines. So all the disciplines were end up to be specialties, and they stopped dialoguing the way we are.
Correct.
And they didn't have the language to do it. They didn't have the environment. And with television and the satellite, which completes the extensions, we arrived at a time when you should come up with the language, and McLuhan did.
Correct. So let me just read a couple texts here from McLuhan. They're both texts that we like very much, and it's one that you just cited with the phrase arrogant superiority.
Okay.
So here he is from the Hot and Cool interview. Media, after all, are only extensions of ourselves. The road to understanding media effects begins with arrogant superiority.
Ah.
If one lacked this sense of superiority, this detachment, it would be quite impossible to write about them. It would be like an octopus attacking the Great Pyramids.
Wow.
Right?
I totally forgot that he said that. I knew he would said it somehow, but I forgot that was where it is.
Okay, but here he is from the Playboy interview. But without this detached involvement, I would never objectively observe media. It would be like an octopus grappling with the Empire State Building. So
he repeats himself. And when was the first one?
How do you mean?
When
you
was
want
that
the whole thing
stated?
Again? Or?
Date-wise.
Oh, 67 was
that's
Hot and Cool interview.
Right. And so within a year, he's in 68, he's doing it again.
The Playboy interview, yeah. But look at what he's saying here in terms of what we've been discussing earlier. We're talking about a situation in which the world is sort of spiraling out of control because it has no language to talk about what it's doing, where it's at. So that's like an octopus attacking the Great Pyramids or an octopus grappling with the Empire State Building. The world has evolved into a kind of impossible situation where it can't do anything but step on its own feet, which is what... You know, an insane octopus is always doing, right? Because its feet are everywhere.
Yeah.
So he says that what you need is this arrogant superiority. And he says that this sense of superiority is a sense of detachment. So what he's saying is what we need is a new science. Because a new science gives a new sort of detachment from ourselves that tells us we're doing.
Yeah.
And so this sense of arrogant superiority, what is that? Well, that's the new science that always is telling us what we're doing, gives us orientation. But it can only happen when we understand ourselves in a new way.
Right. That's the effect. He's talking technically. He's not talking about a personal emotion, arrogant superiority. It's the recently achieved form of consciousness or that level
of
experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's great because it throws people off. You know, they go, what? He's saying we should become megalomaniacs? You know, no.
Yeah.
But you have to know that you think that's what arrogant superiority refers to. You only have
Correct.
One meaning for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there was... Here's something I want to say before I forget.
Yeah.
I was looking through Paul Krasner's... I was listening to an interview with Mae Brussel, with Paul Krasner in 1972. Uh-huh. And they mentioned an article by Eric Norden in The Realist, Krasner's Mad Magazine. He was the first underground paper. Realist started in the late 50s. So in 66, Eric Norden, who interviewed McLuhan for Playboy, writes this incredible article. And it's very prophetic in terms of assassination of Kennedy and the new paranoia and all the stuff and the failure of liberals. Liberals are screwing up. I will send it to you. You know, I think you'll find it quite interesting that the awareness, quite aware and sophisticated, comes to McLuhan and can't understand McLuhan.
Yeah. I was going to say to you that you've mentioned in past conversations that Norton didn't understand anything about McLuhan, and McLuhan had to rewrite the interview to some extent.
Yeah, he got McLuhan to write the answers. It was not oral, eventually. And that's why McLuhan, people say, how can a guy say that? He has a whole column or page of commentary, right? And it's just his science talking technically, but it's not the kind of thing you do in a Playboy interview or any interview. You don't talk like that. Was it somebody, McLuhan said, somebody said he talks like a book or something. But the reason, he didn't talk it. He could talk it, but he basically wrote it. That's what's not understood.
That's what, in this case, I mean, we do have all sorts of him, examples of him speaking extemporaneously.
Yeah.
And sometimes he said, absolutely brilliant stuff. Along with saying a tremendous amount of repetitive, banal stuff.
Yeah. So what's interesting, you read Eric Norden's Sophisticated Awareness, the New York literati. He has some authority because he gets to do a lot of Playboy interviews in the 60s. He does Stanley Kubrick, so he has some status there. And he wrote some novels, I think. And he's writing for the avant-garde magazine, The Realist. But what the important point is his lack of understanding of what McLuhan was saying.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. It was basically Norden was living back in the 20s, and he encountered the 60s, and he didn't know what to make of it.
Mm. So isn't a big problem here that in order to understand McLuhan's language, you need to engage with him repeatedly, where you say to yourself, here's something I don't understand, or here's something that I think is wrong, and it's not McLuhan that's wrong, it's not McLuhan that's not understanding, it's me.
Yeah.
And you have to kind of reverse on yourself all the time, and through that process you learn his language.
Yeah.
And so you've done that. I've done that.
Yeah.
Maybe a few other people have done that, but most people have not. And if you just come to McLuhan without that preparation, then there's no way to understand what he's talking about.
Yeah. And it's more out there than abstract art or surrealistic art. It's another level of perception that nobody's doing in the other art forms. In the old Gutenberg art forms.
Yeah.
So in that way, he was the greatest actor of his day.
Yeah. So that's sort of what John Cage recognized in McLuhan, right?
Yeah.
That McLuhan was talking about processes that Cage and his fellow artists were sort of grappling towards and were expressing on one level, but Cage recognized that McLuhan was talking about this stuff on another level.
Yeah, and Cage and them couldn't solve their problems because they're staying within the Gutenberg performance. McLuhan figured how to use all his faculties, mainly around speech and maybe what he was wearing, as a communication, as a movie, as a TV show, as a composition, even one of silence. All those forms that the avant-garde were doing were falling short of what McLuhan was doing. They would have to give up their program, their art, for a while and sit at McLuhan's feet and learn the language and do the procedure and figure it out. Then see what they can do with the old arts. Might not want to do anything after that.
Yeah, I agree with that, but I would also say that at the same time, McLuhan was sitting at the feet of lots of artists.
Yeah.
Right? He wasn't evolving this stuff just sort of a cloud in his brain or something. He was interrogating the arts and all of the arts.
He was responding to their contribution to the dialogue, and they didn't know how to respond to his response.
Yes. Yes,
but he was being a participant. Remember, he's detached involvement.
Yeah.
And he's involved. He's looking at what Cage does. He says, well, this is very interesting. I say this to that. And then Cage is sort of thrown by that and then goes off and tries to find an answer for McLuhan. He's not ready to give a response right then. And maybe never could. So they actually put McLuhan on a pedestal and don't dialogue with him because they haven't learned how to do it. They're too stuck in their specialism. Yet he's talking to their specialism, improving on it, showing this is what you mean, Mr. Cage, not what you think you mean. This is what you mean.
Yeah, and so that is like taking the step towards a new paradigm, towards a new language. It's like somebody as Watt, for example, is doing the steam engine, and then later people come along and they say, well, here is the chemical understanding of what was going on with those molecules in the steam engine.
Something
like that is going on with McLuhan.
Here's what the public interest, why it happened, why it went that way.
It's like a new understanding of dynamics.
Right, and it's a new kind of ESP because he's talking about the culture, which he, as a human being, has no real proof of what he perceives. He's projecting, as people used to say, his opinion and making a big deal out of it. Well, it's not his opinion, and it's a kind of ESP. He knew how to respond to streaking when it happened correctly, to say what it meant. Nobody else knew that streaking meant what he said it meant, you know, going nowhere fast.
Right. Well, notice that science introduces ESP. When chemistry gets going between 1780 and 1880, what happens is there's a new kind of information in the world that comes to humans sort of automatically. It comes to humans through everything, through what they eat and how they eat and how they go somewhere and how they interact with other humans and stuff. There's this new layer of information to the world.
Caused by the electric environment. The outer extensions, their outer activity was grounded by an internal extension, an extension of the internal.
Correct. And this is a form of ESP because it's a constantly incoming information that is not sensory in the normal sense of sense.
Not the normal inputs.
Correct.
No, very good. Yeah, electronics is ESP. ESP was natural, but not the literate. It's not literate ESP.
Correct. It's second nature.
You know, and a lot of the Comedy Channel, they make people aware of what they've been noticing on the ESP level. So a comedian come in and talk about conventional events, often media characters, celebrities and this and that, lay out some patterns, and you see the people lighting up. They're laughing, but they're learning. And so the ESP that was there, the comedian evokes.
Yes. Yeah, George Carlin did that especially.
Yeah. And, you know, he listened to many of my recordings of my shows.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Jerry Fialka was doing Zappa and got him helped Zappa's wife organize the mail order thing because Zappa wasn't being promoted by the record companies properly. So George Carlin was in a slump in the early 90s, and he found out about how successful Zappa's mail order catalog was, and he found out Jerry was part of it. So he asked Jerry to work at Carlin's every now and then, and Zappa was dying of cancer. This is in 93. So Carlin gets a hold of Jerry, and so Jerry starts helping him get his mail order thing going. And I visited there one day, and I didn't get to meet George. He was down on the first floor in his office talking to a comedian from The Simpsons and talking and making Carlin laugh. So Jerry and I were talking, but the point was I said, Jerry, give Carlin some of my recordings from my CKLN show. And Jerry did that. And he didn't hear back about them for a year. Finally, after a year, Carlin returned them, and he says, I can't understand this guy. And they're funny, what I'm saying, but he didn't get what it was. That's what I was just saying about John Cage couldn't get McLuhan. He didn't know how to respond. Carlin didn't know how to respond to me.
But maybe he understood on another level.
Well,
maybe
what
he understood without understanding. Like when a child is learning a language, they don't really know that they're learning the language. They don't have the means to do that, but they learn it.
Yeah, so here's the proof. He then, in 94, 95, took off again. He had a big retrieval, and the Carlin everybody talks about now is that guy, after he heard my tapes, he started doing these seminars and doing a lot about language. And I've seen some of these shows, and I said to Jerry, that he got that from me. And so he actually did.
And I think I told you already that when Carlin was a boy, he went to school on the Upper West Side. And one of his classmates was the daughter of Bernie Muller Team.
Really?
Who was the best man at McLuhan's wedding and the godfather of both Eric and Mary.
Yeah, the original McLuhan partner, the original comedian partner of McLuhan.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So Carlin's first girlfriend was the daughter of Muller Team.
Holy cow.
So Carlin had this connection with McLuhan via Muller Team and then via you without ever having a direct connection with him.
Right. And what did you say? Okay, so he dated the daughter. Oh, I thought you said there was some other thing in there you said about Muller Tim. I don't know. Okay. So the, there he was involved with the ground. And he may have been one of the first teaching McLuhan, the ESP comedian. Because as people got more into that, living ESP in the 90s, that's when he really blossomed. He really, you know, he ended his career with really big success, right?
Yeah,
no one knows that he was in a slump for a few years before that.
Yeah,
and so the linguistic aspect that I noticed, and Jerry did, was his translating what he had learned from my tapes. Now, it's pretty fucking arrogant to say this, but I'm talking technically here.
Yeah. But the thing that I mentioned, and that may have been, you may have wanted to say something about it, is I said that Muller Team was the best man.
Oh, that's what it was.
And then the godfather of Eric and Mary.
Yeah, so he was the best man at Marshall's wedding, which was on the run in August 39, August 4th, I think. And then you're saying he was the godfather?
Yeah, he was godfather of both Eric and Mary.
And probably Terry, since they were twins.
No, he wasn't. No, they had two separate godparents for the twins. Originally, what happened with Mary is that somebody else
was going to be the godparent, the godfather, and something happened. I can't remember off the top of my head what it was, but they needed a godparent at the last moment. And so Marshall turned to Bernie, and he became the godparent of Mary, even though it was unusual to have a godparent of two children. Usually you want to have separate godparents
right.
for each child.
And he also had to be quick on his feet for the marriage, because wasn't that done really quickly? McLuhan went down and saw, met the family, and then they remember he told Mary to buzz off if she wouldn't marry him, and she changes her view and says okay. So I think they go down and meet the parents, and then they run back up and get the passports and take off.
Oh, I see. You're saying Mary, but you mean Corinne.
Oh. Yeah, Corinne. Sorry, yeah, Corinne.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, that marriage was very quick. He basically they were together in St. Louis.
Yeah,
and they were at a junction where they were either saying goodbye
yeah.
or they were going to get married.
Yeah,
and I think Corinne's point of view was, well, we don't have to get married right away if we're serious and we love each other. Then when you come back from England, that'll be time enough. And Marshall said, no way, I'm not going to do it. We're either getting married now or we're signing off. And Corinne said, okay. Well, originally she had said, okay, so we're signing off. I'm going back to Texas. And so she had made the arrangements to go back to Texas, and she decided at the very last minute that they were going to get married. And
yeah,
so,
he decided not to go back.
That's right. That's right. And so that meant that they had to not only get married, but she didn't have a passport.
Yeah.
And she didn't, of course, have tickets to go on the boat. All of that had to be done very rapidly.
Yeah, and did they go down and did they go and see the parents? I don't know. It sounds like it was too fast, but they go to see the parents at some point. And would that be before the crisis weekend, so to speak?
I think what you may be thinking of is I believe Corinne went back. Marshall had to do something else, had to get something organized.
Mm.
But I think Corinne made a quick trip. Back to, you know, tell her parents what had happened and to maybe get, you know, clothes and stuff
yeah.
like that. And then they met somewhere. Maybe they didn't even meet again until New York. I'm not sure.
Right. So, yeah, I'm right to think that they needed to contact the parents. They had to go back and do something. They had to tell them in person
yeah.
what was going on.
Yeah, but Marshall didn't. I mean, that was just Corinne, I think.
Okay.
My memory is that she went alone
yeah.
after they got married. But, you
okay.
know, that's just off the top of my head.
Okay, so that was good. Let's just see. We're going to end soon, but I want to see what I say.
Yeah, we're almost at the new chapter, so that we just have to finish the chapter we're on.
Yeah, what is that? We only got one page left.
That's right, 159 we have to do.
Okay, let's see if we can do that.
And you already started that with the digital being a part of a sequence with television, global theater, and instant replay.
Yeah, so the beginning of the digital, which I'm calling the Android meme, would be the cable TV scenario in the late 70s, early 80s. So I'm saying cable TV is somehow digital.
Yeah. And notice how if you call the digital, if you call that the Android meme, then that goes to the inflation article where tactility can be made into a product.
Yeah, so
right, the digital takeover by the Android main.
Yeah, the digital. Oh, that's the ground, because the digital hijacks and exploits the analog.
Yeah.
And so that is, the analog is tactility, well, electric tactility. And that, something has to exploit that. And, yeah, you're right, that's the digital. The digital is what takes over. I don't know if I ever had that clear in reference to that essay, Media Approach to Inflation, the ground. I was kept saying, what is the ground when tactile is the figure? It's the digital, which is the machine starting to extend themselves, not our faculties.
Yeah, I can buy that.
Okay, so that, let's see if I say something like that. So I say that's when digital, this is in the casual part, that's when digital autonomy started coming in. People could make their own video recordings on their VCRs and tape shows for when they wanted to watch them later. So that's the beginning of the AP, the anthropomorphic physical, the autonomy. In other words, the human has found a way to get detached from the global mishmash, the global implosion, the global super involvement. How do you get your arrogant superiority back? You get it through the digital, which starts to give you freedom from the imposition of analog media.
Right. But, of course, this is all it's freedom slash pseudo-freedom.
Yep.
And digital slash pseudo-digital, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, this is not the solution. It's the environment that's presenting the solution that you have to become conscious of. You have to become conscious of the effects of it.
Correct.
So the digital was obsolesced by the after image. That's the Internet of the 90s. So the digital and the Android meme for me is the ground of the tiny note chart from 1960 to 1990. Many of the MIT computer scientists of the 50s, 40s and 50s, you know, the Macy conference, they strike out on their own to actually become autonomous in 1960 and form companies in Boston. And they,
yeah.
start to exploit the digital situation. And
correct.
Completes by 1991, 92, and then the after image of that is the Internet, which means, just like the tactility is the after image in the 70s article, the Internet. So what is the ground of the Internet, which is an after image? Well, I guess it's the tech Android meme phase 2 or the tech body, or I don't know. We'll have to see what I come up with there.
Yeah. But notice it's so what you're talking about in the 1960s is, for example, DEC, D-E-C, Digital Electronic Company. So the center of this in Boston moves to the California.
Yeah.
Silicon Valley, and that's the movement that you're talking about between the image and the after image.
Yeah.
Is the same as that movement from East Coast to West Coast.
Yeah, and you're calling the West Coast tech?
No, I was saying that the DEC, D-E-C, the DEC company, which made mini computers, which was actually a fairly big computer. DEC was the center of the technology
of Boston.
In Boston, yeah. And so by 1990, many of those companies were basically bankrupt in
right.
Boston, and their business had been taken over by the micro. Computer. So microcomputers got named as being smaller than the mini.
And what was a company? Is that Hewlett-Packard or?
The Hewlett-Packard, Apple.
Sun Systems.
Those are.
Sun something.
Pardon me?
Sun something. Sun Systems.
Yeah, so Sun, that came out of Stanford. That was Sun was Stanford University Network, that came out of Stanford, just like Google later did.
Yeah.
So all of these are Silicon Valley companies
took over the business from Boston, and now they're in the process of losing it, but probably losing it to centers that are outside the United States.
Well, they're losing it to us, to Iandum.
Maybe.
So the so I would say East Coast is New York. L.A. is West Coast. I have it on the tiny note that the Atlantis is the left hemisphere technology of the East Coast and Europe, and Lemuria is the moving towards the Pacific and the technology of the Silicon Valley. I would say that's going from Wiener on the East Coast to McLuhan on the West Coast, because McLuhan is more identified with the California scene in the long run, you know, his popular image in the media, than the East Coast. Would you agree
with
that?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, because California is more like Southern culture than it is like the Northern culture.
Of New York,
and
yeah.
McLuhan had always been bigger fan of the South against the North.
Yeah, and I think one of the McLuhan daughters is an employee of Facebook or Google.
You know,
the daughters of...
her husband.
Yeah.
The husband of... one of the kids.
I think it's the daughter of Eric, her husband. Maybe her name is Anne or something.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think you're absolutely right about that, yeah.
So the only McLuhan employee, the only offspring of McLuhan ends up in California, appropriately. That's the language of
and
God.
Notice the movement is... going with the sun.
Yeah.
Right? From east to west, and it keeps on going until it gets to Maui.
That's right. The new world. Okay. The digital was obsolesced by the after image, the internet of the 90s, of the Android meme. The after image of the Android meme, and it's this after image is phase two. Android meme phase one is 1960 to 1990. Phase two of the Android meme is the after image, what we call the internet, wherein the Civil War was not in the mediascape anymore. So that's partly what I'm saying up above about TV was not the Civil War, not in the Civil War. There's a new one. Wherein the Civil War was not in the mediascape anymore, the tactile interplay between analog versus digital media squared, but between the autonomous parts of the after image of the Android meme, not involved with or indifferent to surplus flesh. Now, let me see that. Wherein the Civil War was not in the mediascape anymore, that's analog media, and that's the tactile interplay between analog versus digital, it moved into the autonomous parts of the after image of the phase one Android meme. And that means not involved and different to surplus flesh, because it's the machinic that's being extended, not anything from the human flesh. Not involved with, indifferent to surplus flesh. So the autonomous parts of the after image are what I say in other parts, the machine starts extending itself. So phase one is the machine extending itself. Now let me see, is the machine extending itself in the ground in the 60s, maybe. Definitely it's doing it in the 90s. And people don't know what they're buying. They don't understand these machines, where they came from. Mm-hmm. They're not from our bodies. So
can we say that Android meme phase one is Android meme unconscious, and Android meme phase two is Android meme conscious?
Yeah, because the unconscious, there's no clue. I mean, DEC and these companies you were citing, they're digital, but aren't they more embedded in analog media, in a sense? I don't know. What are they in relation to analog media?
Well, you could say that they're a digital component of an analog culture, of an analog economy.
Right. The digital is the unconscious. It's not even noticed. Right?
Yeah, it's a efficiency tool, you could say.
Efficiency, right. So it's the Android meme phase one, which is the unconscious. And that becomes the figure in Android meme phase two.
Correct. So here you have a whole culture or a whole economy. And that's what Silicon Valley was, the brain of this new creature.
Yeah, it obsolesces flesh. Surplus flesh.
Yeah.
And so this is great. So you're helping make my book make sense.
Well, it can't be done unless the sense is already there.
Right. And I'm thinking that's what McLuhan did. He had to go public and make his stuff part of the public dialogue to find out what he meant.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. He often said that.
Yeah.
That's why he liked talking so much. And one of the reasons he never reviewed his essays or his books is that he didn't want to become involved with trying to figure out what he was talking about. He wanted to move on to the next thing.
He wanted to find out what you were talking about, meaning the others, not himself.
Yeah.
So then I say, the traditional war was a civil war of the media with bankers on the sidelines. But the civil war in the – now, this is – I'm predicting – this should be an interesting statement here. I don't even remember it. But the civil war in the 90s is between the parts of the afterimage or the machinic, not media environments. And it's indifferent to surplus flesh because surplus flesh of the chemical body was starting to be bigger than the digital environment. That's interesting. This is where the AP we're coming up to, the anthropomorphic physical, is becoming back, which I have as the ground of my chart, the Dobbs quadrant. You know, it's beneath the analog media of the first four quadrants. And remember, the digital part of the analog media of the four quadrants is the column on the left, the holeopathic. That's the shrinking. And swallowing of the hologram. That's a digital process. So the digital is there in the ground, in the words holeopathic. And the first four quadrants. And we're moving towards the deeper ground. Is the chemical body becoming something new, multi-bodied? Or that's what we project on it as our anthropomorphic physical, that we have different bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty good.
But at a yet deeper level, what's going on here is what's called humanism in the last paragraph of Take Today, or hominization in different parts of McLuhan's work. So the issue of what is the human is a kind of cloud that's descending upon everything.
Yep.
And the parts of that cloud can be exploited into products, or they can be considered as a new understanding. And it's the battle is between those two senses of humanism.
Right. Now, Deleuze and Guattari talk about the body without organs. But Croker comes along and talks about organs without bodies. And that's what I mean by the parts. The parts of the afterimage is the digital ear, the digital tongue that Croker talks about, the floating parts of the splayed SPLAYED of the chemical body. So these parts are floating around as figures. That's the closest of remembering the chemical body that we were extending in the analog phase. Now you're in the digital. And so you got the floating parts of the body, organs without bodies, and the body itself is the surplus flesh which has been cast aside, and it's imploding or becoming something that's bigger than the digital, and that's the AP. So the next paragraph, today, one is wearing the Android meme on one's wrist. Now, what is the wrist part of? It's not part of your chemical body. Maybe it's just the wrist. It's a separate organ. And the Android meme is smaller than it. It holds the Android meme. That's what I mean, that the AP is holding the scattered after image of the parts and of the first Android meme phase. So if surplus flesh is expendable, unions die, that's trade union, workers' unions, die, nobody cares, they just want to get home and engage their TV body and chip body. So then I say, Web 2.0 replays the analog eras, that's the internet, the Android meme, no, Web 2.0 is the social media, the teens. Web 2.0 replays the analog eras, the Android meme sculpting everybody into a pharaoh. That's the co-anesthesia, putting you in the director's seat. One of the great services of the Android meme. Here's my picture of that war mapped out in late 1995, and that's the tiny note chart. That's a picture of the war. And the war is, I just jumped ahead just a second. The war is the Android meme sculpting everybody into a pharaoh. And I'm thinking of McLuhan in the Burroughs book and Burroughs' essay in 1964 saying, it is Egyptian where we were at in the global membrane phase. So then what do I do? That ends. So then we're it. We're Now I'm getting to I predicted we'd get to the AP. I didn't even know it was coming. I forgot. Well, that was a pretty good explanation of how we got to the AP, which we're going to find out what I meant by having you comment on it.
There you go.
Yeah.
And you brought up Egypt a couple times there, and we should remember the characterization of the age as octopus attacking the Great Pyramid.
Oh, yeah, good point, yeah. And the Empire State Building is a modern pyramid, I guess, right?
Yep.
Okay, so awesome. That's fantastic. We only got 20 pages or so left.
Yep. We may have to start again, though, Bob, because as we get towards the end of the book, at least in my case, I'm understanding more about the start of the book.
Yeah, what did I mean? Yeah, we find out what was the impulse that got me going, which was the tech
That's
body,
right.
But we didn't know what it was. So we've talked ourselves into understanding the effects in this article, so we're arriving at the causes.
Correct.
Awesome. Amazing. So is this the first novel, a new kind of science fiction novel, where Bob talks to somebody who kind of knows what he's talking about, and then we find out what the book's about?
Yeah. Well, we talked about that circle in the course of our conversation today. But everything human works like that.
Yeah.
You always arrive at a point that was already the case. You go towards the past. You have to repeat what you were about to say.
Right. Now, listen to this. So in an interview in 91, Zappa was asked something, whether art was imitating life or life was imitating art. Now, this is what's popular, just an average person talking to Frank, but they've been massaged by the Android meme 1960-1990 to understand McLuhan instinctively that the interplay of art and life was getting blurred. So he says, what is it, Frank? Is it art imitating life or life imitating art? And he says, it's both. It's loops. And looping is, tactility. So what you were just saying is we're looping the past, the present,
yeah,
the future. What did you say?
Sure.
We're going back. What did you just say? It was accurate. It was the looping.
We have to repeat what we were about,
yeah,
to say.
Yeah.
That's straight from McLuhan. But it's if you think of a child learning language, the child cannot understand the instructions unless it understands language. But the instructions are about how to understand language. So that kind of loop is always going on with humans, but it's unconscious and it's not used for proper understanding. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to say that we're trying to use language to teach a new language.
Yes, and leading up to the Gutenberg era, art imitates life. Then in the Electric Age, life imitates art. Now they're looping back and forth, but that's the sequential. First, art imitates life, and then life imitates art. Then you realize it's simultaneous, and you never began where you thought you were. And that becomes the looping tactile blur, which is always our condition. Now, the cloud,
yeah,
well, I'll end with this. The cloud, Ian talks about the cloud, and he talks about the Google Microsoft cloud, and Ian is making a new cloud, a better cloud. And it's very interesting how he describes it. We're not sure what it is, but we're growing it, and I would call the cloud, the way you were saying it, the mystery landscape, which is becoming the mystery body. That we're moving into the cloud, which is the mystery body. The parts of ourselves that we never understood are now becoming,
mm-hmm,
figure. That's the cloud you see falling over people today. But we have moved. What?
No, I'm disagreeing with you.
Yeah. And we're moving into the hexadic, into the sixth level, which is Iondom, and maybe the new ground. Well, I'm saying.
And that mysticism is the new science.
Yeah. But
it's
beyond all the cliches of what mysticism is. Nothing to do with that. Just like it's all beyond the cliches of what science is. It is a new situation that cannot be understood. And here's the breakthrough technology happening just now, so we're talking this way appropriately. It's being caused by the events at Georgia Power, where they're announcing something new, and they fucking had to lie, and it's nowhere near what they're fucking trying to describe. No, there it is. That's what Finney's Wake started off. Right?
Well, I don't want to say right, because I haven't fully understood what you said, but I don't think I can understand that at the moment.
Well, the point is that Dobbs is making stuff, and he never needed to know anything about what he was doing.
Well, that's
ESP. That's ESP.
That's right. That is ESP.
Well, there we have it. You understand something. Here at page 169.
Yes,
at the top. So fantastic. Okay, thanks a lot, Cameron. Very good.
Okay, Bob. Look forward.
Yep.
Bye.
Talk to you next.